Sylvester, author of the Neil Flambe Capers, and you are listening to Authors Like Us.
Hey,
hello.
Is this Kevin?
Yeah, it is.
Hey, how's it going?
Do I have my video on? I don't. Hold on, I'll turn on my video.
This just, all right. We're having
technical difficulties here.
That's okay.
That's okay. I always have technical difficulties.
We're going to get along famously.
Yeah, we'll get along fine.
Perfect.
Oh, hey, there we go.
Oh, there you are.
Wow, well, look at you. You're a lot more professional than we are.
You've got a headset, and looks like you're in a nice... is this your studio?
This is, no, my living room.
Oh, your living room looks... Okay, well, it looks very bookish.
Yeah, it's pretty bookish. Is that good? Should I angle it so that you can actually see the bookcase?
There we go.
Is that a globe, even? You've got a globe?
I do have a globe, yes.
You have, you have my dream living room.
Inuit art.
Yeah, you've awesome. Got the whole thing going on.
I guess that would be... It's not Inuit art, but anyway. Haida Gwaii or something. How are you guys doing?
Oh, we're great. So I guess we haven't officially met. So I'm Lee.
Yeah, I'm James.
Hey.
And welcome to the big show, Authors Like Us.
Excellent.
Welcome to our podcast.
Thank you very much.
So you heard about us through your cousin.
My cousin Dave, yeah. He was at Kids Books, I guess, and I think bumped into you, James.
He bumped into me, yeah. It's my on-again, off-again job. And they saw me, they were very surprised to see me, because I think they moved, too. They used to be regulars of mine, and then when they saw me, they said they were in town, and they mentioned that they knew you, and I said to them, well, I have this podcast show, so if they'd like, you know, if Kevin would like to come on, we'd love to have him, it'd be great.
Yeah, I'm totally game. Yeah, they live in London now. Dave's at Western.
Oh, cool. We both teach at a writing program based here in Vancouver. We might be starting something up in London, Ontario, so.
Ah.
Yeah, my partner's on the way there a couple weeks from now, so.
Fantastic. Yeah.
And you're in Toronto.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah. You were actually came to Kids Books once to sign your books, and I just missed you.
Yeah, I was in town for something. Oh, I did the Ice Age with the Hard Rubber Orchestra. I did a show at the Kerrisdale Arena, or Harry Jerome Rink, or whatever the heck it was, up in North Van.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that wouldn't be Kerrisdale, but... Yeah.
No. I got that mixed up in my own head, sorry.
That's okay. So this is pretty cool. I remember listening to you on CBC, and, you know, in my recollection, it was like last year, but I'm assuming that was more a few years ago, because you had been on the show mentioning how you were interested in becoming a children's author.
Yeah.
And so you're fairly newly published, is that correct, or
what, a year now?
I've had books out. My first book was 2001.
Okay.
So it was more like I wanted to do it full time.
Oh, okay.
I was hosting Sounds Like Canada, the show, the summer show.
Right.
It was Sheila Rogers' show.
Yeah.
And I did it for the summer, and it was the summer that Harry Potter, the last Harry Potter, was coming out. So what we decided to do was write a book on air, which was Neil Flambe, the radio version.
I've got it here.
Yes, that's the one. Hey, I've got it here, too.
I feel left out. I don't have mine.
You can touch it.
There, what? Here. I'll hold it, too.
It's got a good feel to it. It's nice and sturdy.
It's
interesting that you're biting your book, because this book, obviously, with the name of Neil Flambe, is a lot about cooking. You obviously know a lot about cooking.
I love it. Well, I'm sort of like Neil. I watch a lot of the Food Network and then write notes down so that I sound like I know what Japanese purple shiso leaf is and stuff like that.
You had me fooled.
I know.
Or convinced.
I fooled myself, too. Well, I end up doing all the cooking in my family, and it's sort of, I'm not like a chef or anything, but my mom was always how we connected, was I would be in the kitchen. I'm the oldest boy, the oldest kid, and that's what you do. You'd go in the kitchen and you'd cook with your mom, and you'd clean up afterwards as well, which I think was why she let me cook. And so I still do all the cooking in my family, and I love it. Like, the neat thing was she sort of went through that period where she was in a cooking club. And what they do is each meal, it was like once a month, they'd have a theme. So it might be Mexico one month, or French the next, American barbecue the month after. So it was always like that was our thing for the whole month, was we'd go through cookbooks looking for recipes and ideas. And so I love it. I mean, cooking's an absolutely amazing way to spend your time. It's very relaxing. And at the end of it, you get to make something. It's like art.
And you get to eat it.
Which is better than art.
Which is better than
I
art.
I tried it with a book and I chipped a tooth, so it didn't work out the same way.
So I guess you didn't really have to do a lot of research then for this book. It came naturally. It was a natural thing to put into the book.
Yeah, although the thing you have to do research on is because Neil is a great chef, and you sort of have to know what the Gordon Ramsay's, Mario Batali's of the world are actually cooking, because they do, you know, like there's that Thomas Keller cookbook that came out a few years ago, the French Laundry cookbook, and some of the recipes take 4 days to prepare. I never do that. You have to know about that so that you can sort of throw that into the mix so that Neil, that's the sort of stuff Neil would make, is stuff that he wants to sort of blow you away and intimidate you with.
Have you actually done any events in restaurants to promote your book?
We did a no.
Well, here's an idea for you.
You were searching for a better answer, but that's it.
Yeah, I don't really know. Not yet. I mean, the second book is out this fall, and it's based in Mexico City, and so there's some talk of having that at an actual restaurant. I did, when I did book launch for book one, I did a sort of a cooking demonstration, but because it's kid-friendly, it was more like I had 20 ingredients, and I called up two kids, and I said, you can pick five and make a sandwich, and we made panini or something.
That's pretty cool.
It was more, well, it was neat because what was interesting is the thing about food is it's not universal, right?
Yeah.
So one kid picked a vegetarian sandwich, and the other kid, like, put every gross combination you could imagine, right? Pickles of peanut butter and egg salad and lettuce. And I said, you had to eat it, and he ate it. And he put potato chips in, which was actually really, really cool because it adds a sort of a crunchy texture to it.
So. I would make, I don't know if you know, but we have this little thing going on, James and I, where James is on the street meat challenge.
You got to bring that up, right?
Yeah. Every time we go to a city, we have to try and get him to eat street meat. So maybe you should go to one of Kevin's events and have to make the sandwich. Actually, I'll make the sandwich and you have to eat it.
Yeah, we're not doing that.
I was just in Beijing and I was just desperate for him to I wish he had been with me because they have some really interesting street meat in Beijing.
I don't have the same stomach I had when I was in my 20s.
See, but I think it's actually better if you don't have a strong stomach, because then if it turns out to be rat, you can throw it up easily.
Yeah, well, I guarantee you for the plane ride home, all the other passengers were the ones paying for it.
Yeah, that recycled air is a killer every time. I was going to say, when I was down in Mexico City a couple years ago, and it's the basis for the second book, and I love this, I love trying out street meat, and I you know, lucky enough to have gone to a number of Olympics and sporting events in places like Moscow, where you can buy amazing barbecue off the street, Athens, all these amazing places. And I wanted to get stuff at the Zocalo, the downtown square, and our guide, who was a young woman from Acapulco originally, refused. She absolutely refused to let me eat any of it because she said it's all made out of rat or dog.
That's
which
awesome.
I said, I don't care. Like, I want to try it. But she said, no, you'll get poisoned. You'll get poisoned. It was like she was afraid that this North American guy was going to go to Mexico City and die, and it would be like
her
a bad
fault.
PR or something. I don't know.
So you never got to eat it? You didn't?
No. The only thing she let me have was this amazing, it was a really nice, I forget the name of it right now, but it's a traditional kind of a dish, which is a hard a brown or blue corn tortilla with a kind of a cheese and vegetable and chili salsa on top of it that they bake a little bit just to sort of broil it. And man, that was amazing. Absolutely amazing.
But no meat.
No meat.
You didn't, you didn't sneak out afterwards and try and get some, or...
I tried. I actually ordered one from somebody, and it was just like a little, wrapped up pulled meat sort of a sandwich. I thought it was pretty good.
Okay.
But she slapped it out of my hand before I could eat it.
You're clearly alive, so.
Yes, I enjoyed it.
And you understand the whole street meat thing then. That
I
makes
love
sense
it, yeah.
to you. Yeah, me too. We were in Penticton, and I found, what was it, a buffalo sausage or something. And oh, it was awesome. It was so good. Nobody else would try it.
There was a great, when I worked up in Inuvik for a short time, and I loved, there was this little van that would pull up and down the street, and it sold muskox burgers and smokes.
Which did you try?
I stuck to the muskox burgers. Yeah,
excellent.
I didn't go for the smokes, but it was, I thought it was great. It's, you know, muskox burgers out of a van. Amazing.
So I never knew my brother lived up there. I just my brother is famous for his
eating what he hunts.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
What did he let me try when I was
you
there?
Ate moose moose sausage. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic stuff. Yeah. Moose is great.
It was great. Yeah, it tasted really good. So this is not the vegetarian episode that we're doing right now. If you are an animal rights activist listening to this, turn it off now.
That's right. Yeah. Sorry about that. Yeah, well, I'm an omnivore. Definitely an omnivore.
Kevin, do you have a signature dish?
I was very lucky to have... I spent a little time in northern Italy. I did a documentary on Turin, which is one of the most amazing cities in the world. And I learned how to make good risotto, like proper Italian risotto, where the rice doesn't taste like wallpaper paste and all that sort of stuff. And you can sort of, they're nice dishes because you can almost throw in anything into them. You know, chicken, pesto, peppers, you just sort of mix stuff in, and as long as the broth is hot when it hits the rice and the rice cooks, and you stir it pretty frequently, and then you throw in a lot of butter and parmesan. So that's the one I serve whenever people come over. And in the summer, I use my barbecue to make pizzas, flatbread pizzas.
Oh, cool.
Oh, I've been thinking of doing that too. Do you actually use a stone, like one of those stones that you can put onto the barbecue, or just right on the barbecue?
Right on the grill, yeah. Because the nice thing about a good barbecue is that it'll actually get as hot as a pizza oven. You can't do that with your oven in your house, because they only go up to about 400, 500 degrees. Yeah. If you have a good barbecue, it'll go up to 700 degrees. So it's almost like a pizza oven. And then you make the dough a little bit more substantial. You add some cornmeal and some whole wheat flour to give it a more, I guess, body.
Oh, yeah.
And that way, once it starts to cook on the grill, it stiffens up really quickly. Don't let it rise. That's another thing.
Mm.
And it stiffens up pretty quickly. And then you flip it, oil it, throw some stuff on top, put it on an indirect heat, and it's amazing.
I'm getting hungry just listening to all this. It's like a cooking show. Who knew? This is awesome.
And you can do that one vegetarian.
That's a good point.
Look at that. Yep. We're now the vegetarian-friendly episode again.
Yeah.
That's right. You can tune back in, animal rights activists.
Well, there's a lot of... in this book, I'm just reading it right now because I'm thinking of teaching it to my creative writing class. There's a lot of... Obviously, smell is such an important part in this book. So there's a lot of meat being, or fish, I guess, being smelled in this book. The character can always smell the food and tell if it's gone, well, in the case of fish, rotten.
Yes. So,
this is definitely not a book for vegetarians.
No. Well, although book two, there's some stuff that happens in book two, which turns things around a little bit for his views on food. Because he is very much... Neil, the main character, is very much give me anything and I'll cook it and make it the best meal you've ever had. So he loves beef. I mean, it's sort of funny. Gordon Ramsay, who did a nice little blurb for the front of the book, I watched his show The F Word, and he had someone on who was trying to convince him to be a vegetarian, and he just about attacked the person.
Like physically?
Because if you're a chef, it's too limiting, right?
Yeah. One of my favorite shows is Kitchen Nightmares.
Oh, yeah.
It's awesome. He goes in there. I mean, he is so brutally honest with these people. It's brilliant.
Although it's funny, when you watch the BBC, or the British...
Seen it, yep.
Yeah, that one, he's actually like way more nice and sort of chummy with the guys. But in the American version, I think they're less interested in the food and more interested in the swearing.
Yeah.
So he sort of ramps that up by about 40% for the Americans, I think. the Hell's Kitchen model or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's a great show. You know, and he turns it around and half the time they quit, or the place still goes bankrupt after 4 months or whatever.
Yeah, but it's nice when he does wind up with those little success stories and they go back to see, what happened, and that's pretty cool too.
So, I'd like to go hit one of those, like do a tour where you go to all the places that Gordon Ramsay has saved in the, Pacific Northwest or something, and try out all the food they have.
Well, I actually find now when I go into a restaurant, I open up the menu, if there's like a million things on the menu, because I've watched so many episodes of Kitchen Nightmares, I know that I'm in for a really bad ride.
It's true.
Yeah, if the menu's too long.
Yeah, it's because they don't have any signature dish, they don't know what they're doing, so they're just throwing everything under the sun on there.
Yeah.
And if you go into some place and there's like three or four things, and they actually have a kitchen dish and a special of the day, always get the special of the day.
Yes. because the chef's kind of interested in making it, right? It's like it's their special thing, and usually it's because it has the most seasonal ingredients. That's why it's a special of the day and not a regular menu item.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff, this food.
Yeah, it's amazing. Look, we all eat. I mean, that's the thing I think is amazing. We all eat, and the thing about writing for kids in food is that kids often get knocked for not having a particularly interested palate. You know, there are some kids whose parents have them eat sushi and stuff. But kids, it's like that kid at the my book launch who mixed all those weird things together. You know, he's making a sort of a funny, gross sandwich, that kid, but give him a few years of trying that over and over and over again, and he can come up with coq au vin, right? Yeah. Which is just a bunch of stuff thrown in with some chicken, and suddenly it's like, hey, that's pretty good. I just created a dish. That's like playing with food, which is what they become chefs.
It's like paella.
Exactly right. God only knows what's in half those dishes.
Oh, I love paella. Paella is one of my favorite. Or I was going to say the Korean bibimbap, which to me is just like I'm going to get in trouble. But anyways, for me, I won't say it. Anyways, I don't like bibimbap, but
yeah.
It's like, I don't know if you ever had it. It's a very Korean traditional dish. And actually, I like it on the plain. The plain bibimbap is awesome, but
bibimbap is awesome.
Yeah.
So why I have to ask, why children's books?
I never actually know exactly how to answer that question. I love reading them as part of it. I like writing them. I read everything. I mean, I have a degree in English from university. It's not like I studied Victorian literature. So I first of all, they're fun. They're active. The verbs are sort of straightforward. And I actually think, having been a broadcaster for years at the CBC, and I still am, but I mean, you the way you tell stories on radio is quite linear. It's quite active verbs, short sentences, well-framed ideas. Not that there's not a ton of nuance, but that you're usually being direct. And that actually, I think, leads into kids' writing better than it would probably lead into, say, fiction for adults. I tend to look at writing for kids as a different genre. Mm-hmm. It's not dumbed-down adult stuff. It's a different, more direct, more almost oral, on the page type of storytelling. Adult literature is often built, I find, around the language, the use of words, playfulness with words, juxtapositions of ideas, whereas kids' books are often as if you were telling a story orally, but you're writing it down. They're built along that line of direction, style, that leads into the way the characters are often written. It reads into the way the plots are developed, that sort of thing.
I like that you say that it's not a dumbed-down adult book, because I don't know if you get this, but I know I certainly do, where people think that I write for kids because I can't write for adults.
Exactly.
And I always say to them that if that were true, there wouldn't be so many adult writers trying to write kids' books.
Yes, or pop stars.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Daniel Handler, actually, I saw an interesting interview with him a few years ago, the Lemony Snicket Daniel Handler, who writes for both adults and for kids.
Yeah.
And he said, writing for kids is like writing mystery novels, that there are certain constructs that you have to live with, in the sense that the protagonist is almost always a kid, mm-hmm. and you have to then write a world through the eyes of the kids. So I think he said the same thing. It's a different genre. It's a different skill set. It's a different approach. It's not dumbed down adult literature. And that's a guy who is written critically acclaimed adult novels and hugely popular critically acclaimed novels for kids. So
let's trust his words.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's making more money than any of us.
So for the Neil Flambé, obviously there's a second one coming out. Do you have an idea for an entire series, or are you writing them? I haven't finished this one yet, so excuse my ignorance, but are they one, like, I don't know if this sets, if this book ends with a setup to the next one, or do you have a master plan in mind?
I have a sort of a master plan in mind. This particular book was written, I mean, you might know this if you guys have written series, right? Like, mm-hmm. or approached a series. They always tell you to write the first book more self-contained.
Right.
The second book actually leads more into the third book. This first book, partially because their marketing department wants to see if it sells more than five copies.
Exactly.
Next ones. But basically, the contract with Key Porter is for 4 books, but it could go past that if the series does well. I don't have a story arc like J.K. Rowling had a 7-book story arc already built into her brain for Harry Potter. I don't really have that for Neil.
Okay.
Neil to me is sort of like the Hardy Boys in the right. sense that, you know, they could go on, there could be 100 of them. My kids could write them if they want.
Right. Well, yeah. So some fan fiction going.
You know, why not? I'm totally into that.
It's interesting too, Kevin, because the way you describe that's perfect, because that's the way I wrote my first book in my series, more self-contained, and the second one was a bit more of a cliffhanger. But one of the challenges, of course, we talked about writing kids' books and having a kid protagonist. I don't know if this is something you've thought about with Neil, but obviously with a kid protagonist, they grow. Like, all characters age obviously, but obviously a child ages more dramatically and more significantly, right? Especially, I mean, I guess Neil's 14. That's a very, teenager. There's a big difference between 14 and 16. I mean, he's riding his bike. Is he ever going to get a car?
No. I don't even own a car, and I'm 43.
Neil wills. By that, do you mean that you won't age him through the series, or you'll just keep him on his bike?
No, he'll age. He's 15, actually. The opening scene in book 3, which I've just started writing, is his rather disastrous 15th birthday.
Okay.
So but I don't see him aging. Let's say a year a book or half a year a book or whatever. This one, actually, I got caught a little bit in the chronology because I'd written it as a radio play. The radio play was written as a kind of a 4-month sequence. I don't know. It was just the way that because I was writing it as we went along, that just ended up being sort of the timeline. So when I wrote the book, I sort of had to age him from 14 close to being 15 already. So book 2, I had to actually condense down to 2 weeks. So book 2 actually takes place over only 2 weeks. Book 3, we'll see. Because I like mysteries that unfold in real time. So he'll probably end up hitting 16 if there's a book 6 or something like that.
Okay.
Book 6 or book 7 in my head. And I've already in my head actually started writing an adult Neil Flambé book where he's a burned out alcoholic chef. Lost all of his, 15 Michelin starred restaurants, and is trying to make it as a hot dog vendor in New York or something,
Yeah, he could actually become the next, like, Gordon Ramsay, where he has his own reality show as an adult,
Yes, exactly, and he gets berated. He's too violent or something, throwing knives at stupid sous chefs or something, so.
Do you remember the book series, The Secret Diary of Adrienne Mole?
Of course, yes. And even the TV series as well, I loved it.
She did that too, where she actually wrote one when he's an adult.
That's right.
Yeah, he became a bookseller and still having trouble.
Yes, I think he actually ended up getting married to the girl from the first few books and then getting divorced or so. Like, because I remember reading it when it came out, which was a few years ago, but
it's
like he's a bitter old man now a little bit and his marriage broke up with
Is a real. I don't know how I feel about that.
Chain-smoking Adrienne Mole.
Yeah.
Neil could do that, too.
Yeah, it could be the...
Yeah, but would you... I get the sense, Kevin, that you are totally playing with that idea. Like, you're not being serious about that. Does that help
it's sort of like when you write... I mean, you must do this, too. When you have a character, you project them into the future.
That's what I was going to ask. I do that all the time, but for fun, to help keep me interested and to help develop the character. Because, obviously, you always want to see what the logical... outcome, right? So, it's kind of, I'm such a slow, painfully slow writer. I have to amuse myself in all sorts of ways to keep myself entertained along the way. So, sounds like you wrote Neil Flambé in a very short time. James can famously write a book in a very short time. I cannot, so I'm just envious of you guys.
I have to write them in a very short period of time because the marketing department, I was supposed to do one a year. And the marketing department actually liked the book. It's sort of an odd behind-the-scenes publishing thing where the editors, of course, liked it. They accepted it. But the marketing department, if they think they can sell it, especially in a series, they said, can you up it to one every 6 months? So that's why the first one came out in the spring. The second one's coming out this fall. The third one has to be done by the end of the year, along with the illustrations, because I do the illustrations for the book as well. And then it has to be out in the spring. I'm hoping after that I can buy a little more time for book 4. So I had actually worked out the outline of the plots for the first 3, So that made it a little bit easier.
Yeah.
So but, then you find that I don't know if you guys find this, but then it changes. Like,
right.
As you're writing, a character's take on more significance or less significance. You think it's going to be this guy who did it, and then because they're mysteries, and then you go, nah, I think I'd rather not have that guy do it. This makes more sense to me, and you switch stuff around.
Yeah, that happened to me when I was writing my martial arts book, because I had to give them a chapter-by-chapter outline. I had 4 weeks to write it, and then, it was a harsh deadline. I did it. I managed to do it. But it's also a short book. It was only 20,000 words, so...
That's that Orca Sounders, right?
Yeah, it's like that, but it's Orca Sports, which is their sports version of the Soundings. It happened to me too. I was writing it, and all of a sudden there were characters that were supposed to just be blips on the page, and they became really interesting, and I thought, well, what if he did this instead, and totally changed the ending around, and by the time I sent it to the editor, I thought, they're going to totally reject this, they're going to want the advance back, it's over.
But I think they recognize that, that's the writing process, right? It takes on, I think it takes on a better life when that happens. Just like a painting that isn't exactly the same as the preliminary sketches is almost always a better painting. Because there's a process that refines things down. That's what a writer does. Chiseling away at the extra marble.
That's right, yeah. And you're
David,
you're an illustrator as well. Yeah. And I illustrate as well, but it's pretty rare to be an author-illustrator combo. So, kind of selfishly, I'd just like to ask, how do you work in terms of the illustrations and the writing? Do you, because I get asked this all the time, I tend to do them simultaneously. That's the way, because a lot of my art informs my words. How does it work for you?
I'm the same way, and you're talking about keeping yourself entertained when you're writing. What I'll often do is, as I'm writing, if I hit a wall, let's say after the first 10,000 words or something, which always happens, mm-hmm. I go and I start doing drawings. And then sometimes what happens is something in the drawing triggers what you think might be a next good step in the evolution of the book, for example.
That's totally interesting, because that's exactly how I work.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I can do Stickman.
Excellent.
Do you do Stickman?
Jimmy's made good money doing that, so...
Exactly. I know. It's funny, because I used to always tell my students that, you know, my drawing technique is Stickman, that's it, you know. And then now they all say to me, well, that's all Diary of a Wimpy Kid is. How come you didn't do that?
Yeah.
I don't know. Exactly.
But do you draw Stickman to entertain yourself as you're writing?
Sometimes.
Okay. I mean, I just believe in the power of drawing to help fight writer's block and to keep the creativity going. It's actually the number one thing I teach when I do creative writing workshops for kids is I always get them drawing. Half the time I get them drawing before they're writing because for me, that's how my brain is wired. So it's just interesting to hear that it's the same for you. Kind of makes me feel
good. Although it was interesting, I'm a big fan of the Scott Pilgrim books. And I was watching an interview with Brian Lee O'Malley and he was saying that he actually works out the text ahead of the drawings for those. And those are so visually driven, I find that. He must go in the opposite way. Like, he almost is sort of, he writes the stuff, but then that's almost to get him motivated to go do the illustrations. Like,
wow.
That's what pushes him to get out there and plan the illustrations and the way that he models his books and stuff. So
I can't believe that it just doesn't totally change when he is knee-deep in.
I know.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah, I wonder how much of the original text for him stays true after he's done his illustrations.
But he says it's pretty much set. But you know what it is? He must visually have it in his head. It's just that he hasn't put it down on paper. Because they're paced cinematically as well, his books, right?
Yeah.
So he knows that there's pauses and there's all sorts of things that will find their way in, even though they're not maybe written down in the text that he has. It's written in his brain. So when he hits it, doing the layouts and the roughs, then he goes, oh, this is the bit where action happens, for example.
Yeah, well, my brain, I don't know if my brain can hold, I need more RAM.
Yeah, I need, some, you know, little USB ports or something where you can just pull stuff out and put it back in, for sure.
Yeah.
So we should ask him the question we always like to ask.
We only have one canned question.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've noticed, but we just kind of like to have a chat. We're not really, you know,
we don't really prepare. That's our shtick.
But the one question we always like to ask our guests, and it's kind of our inside joke because we always get asked, you know,
what inspires you the most.
Yeah.
So we're not going to ask you that.
Because we don't like that question ourselves. Because we just get bored with it, I guess. So our question to you is, what does not inspire you?
What does not inspire me?
Yeah, and you can interpret that any way you want.
Hot summer days in my studio.
Wow, that's the fastest anybody's ever answered.
Yeah.
You answered that so fast I didn't catch it. Can you repeat it?
It's hot summer days in my studio. My studio is the third floor of my house, and I am a big fan of cold weather. Cold, rainy weather makes me very happy.
Wow.
And actually, creatively, it's like the summer is the worst time for me to write or draw. I just cannot physically motivate my brain for some reason to get out there and actually do it.
Really?
And you've had quite the heat wave this year too in Toronto.
Yeah, although the funny thing is my house has three trees right around it, and our house has actually been fairly cool, so I'm doing okay.
Oh, good.
That is the fastest someone has ever answered that. Wow, I wish we had an award. But I find it interesting because when it comes to drawing especially, I find that I can't get too motivated to draw or paint in the summer, except at night. I like, once the sun sets, I always find that a great time to be creative. But
I find when it's nice out, you want to be at the beach and you want to be going for a walk. Yep. And there's just too many. Yeah, but we know when it's cold and it's rainy and it's miserable, the last thing you want to do is be outside. So you might as well write.
Yeah, that's true. I find that what I'll tend to do is once the cooler weather hits, I don't know, there's also some sort of association with like a sweatshirt and sweatpants. But I just love that feel. I bring up my morning coffee, I flick on my computer and listen to rain if I'm lucky. And I don't know, there's just, I'll go for 14 hours wrecking my back at a typewriter.
You, really?
Wow.
Oh, yeah. When the weather's cooler, I just love it. I just like being up there. And then what'll happen is I'll often quit at like dinner time, go make dinner, come back up and go, I'll try it for another hour at like 8 o'clock, and I'll go till like 2 in the morning. Just because it doesn't always work like that, but those are like the best days. And you get to the end, you look at the word count and you go, ooh, that's not bad. You know, may end up having to be completely rewritten, but your first draft is almost always, you're impressed that you're actually not stuck at 500 words, you know.
Right.
Hitting the same space button over and over again.
Are you one of those writers, like, for me especially, if I write my first draft, I always expect it to be terrible.
Yes.
I was reading...
And then the second draft is terrible as well, and your editor will always tell you that. I find the first draft is always way too long, way too wordy, way too descriptive.
Yeah.
Like boring patches of people talking too much about something.
Yeah.
And then I have to go, but that's, it's like, then you paint over it. It's like a painting and you paint over
it. Yeah.
Well, actually, that's an interesting comparison because I think when I, just for me as an illustrator, what I do is I end up in an illustration adding more detail or going into little corners of that world I've created within that drawing or painting and expanding them. But I agree with you totally. When it comes to writing, it's deleting. It's paring down. It's an interesting way to think about it, actually.
Well, and often what'll happen is when I go through, if I'm doing, because what I'll do is I'll do illustrations as I'm writing along, but then I'll do the spot illustrations I'm usually doing afterward, like a small one, because the book is a combo of full page and little tiny illustrations as well, and I usually do the small ones later. And I'll find that often if I cut text, I do an illustration to sort of fit that hole in the text.
Yeah.
I'm not missing the text, but I need that somehow a trigger to keep the story going along on the line I want it to. So
that's really cool because this is a really interesting conversation for me because I work very much the same way. And sometimes there's something I want to tell for the story, but I only want to tell it through the picture. I don't want to I don't want to waste words on it. But it allows, it gives you that flexibility to do that, right? Like you can give a little hint of something in the illustration and I don't have to worry about even suggesting it in the words. And especially, I write for even a younger audience than what you've written the Neil Flambé stories for. So I have to be even a little bit more conscious of word count. So it's a really great tool to use to draw upon. No pun intended.
Yeah, I agree. You draw puns.
I'm really bad for the puns.
You always do that.
Yeah.
Actually, that's the first one. You did pretty good today.
I did pretty good today.
Yeah.
So I'm James.
I'm Lee.
And you're listening to
Authors Like Us.